Greetings, you beautiful humans. This is Glenn Klein Online. It's hump day, Wednesday, March 26, 2008. The only March 26, 2008 in history. Welcome in on this Wednesday night, Glenn Klein Online, helping you get over the hump of the week with the Gospel Revolution broadcast with the one and only, you know him, you love him, we just cannot live without him, Mr. Michael Williams. Michael!
Glenn!
How are you, my brother from another mother?
I am just wonderful. How has your day been?
Well, I have no complaints. Compared to some of the things that I heard from some other people's lives today, I definitely have no complaints. Gracie was home not feeling well today.
Aw.
Yeah, but she asked me if we could go to Subway for dinner. And I said to her, well, it's a distinct possibility. And, of course, you know, she's 11 years old. And she said, Pop, what's distinct mean? And I told her, I said, figure it out from the context of the sentence. And she said, does it mean plausible? I said, that's a harder vocabulary word than distinct.
That's for sure.
Speaking of young people, this is not a happy story. Some of you beautiful humans may have seen it in the news. We had, not very far from where you spoke, Michael, in Wisconsin, a young girl died today whose parents tried to pray her out of a diabetic situation. This is from the Associated Press. It says an 11-year-old girl died after her parents prayed for healing rather than seek medical help for a treatable form of diabetes, police said today. Everest Metro Police Chief Dan Virgin said Madeline Newman died Sunday in Weston, just outside Wausau. She just got sicker and sicker until she died, he said. Virgin, who, by the way, beautiful humans, this guy Virgin was a student of Pep Washburn's in Wisconsin, who is the chief of police there. And Virgin said an autopsy determined the girl died from diabetic ketoacidosis, an ailment that left her with too little insulin in her body, and she had probably been ill for about 30 days, suffering symptoms like nausea, vomiting, excessive thirst, loss of appetite, and weakness. The girl's parents, Dale and Lelani Newman, attributed to the death, and now here's the catcher, Mike, here's the kicker. They attributed the death to the fact that they did not have enough faith.
Wow.
They believed the key to healing was to just keep praying better and to call more people to help pray.
Yeah.
Family does not attend an organized church or participate in an organized religion, Virgin said. They have a little Bible study of a few people. The parents told investigators their daughter last saw a doctor when she was 3. Now she's 11. And the mother still believes the girl could be resurrected, the police chief said. So,
I remember the day.
Yeah, I mean, that's very relatable. And it's amazing, even people that believe in the gospel and the fulfillment of all promises at the cross, or they say they do, still somehow are seeking a result from prayer. It's just another step from what these people in Wisconsin have done.
Oh, you know, absolutely. I tell you, the last conference that I just did, which I know we'll be talking about it later, but it brings up the subject in our study in Hebrews and also reflecting that out of the book of John. I'm just learning more and more and more about the subject of faith, and it's just amazing how that all of Hebrews, all of the book of John teaches, this is the foundational element of the conclusion, not the statements taken out of context, but the conclusion of the book of Hebrews and the conclusion of the book of John, both, which one is the book about believing, the other one is the faith book of Paul's writings of the New Testament. And of the letters to the Hebrews, it's the big faith chapter in 11 and so many comments, but if you read that through, you find out in John that believing is not required and that faith is no longer an issue for persons for their relationship with God. And the book of John concluding that nobody could believe because it was foretold by the prophets that no one would believe. And no one believed so that we could be saved from our unbelief by the faith of Christ in the book of John. And then, of course, the conclusion in chapter 12 of Hebrews, it's so amazing after we go through that supposed, Hebrews Hall of Fame of faith people who, at the end of the chapter, received not the promise, but only got a good report. And then chapter 12, the second verse says, looking unto Jesus. And everybody's looking unto this list of people. And it starts out the next chapter, seeing that we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us hold fast to the profession that we have, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of faith.
Well, this is the major topic that was discussed in Dallas, which we do want to get into later. But it just occurred to me, Michael, that, and we do have a caller on the line, but it just occurred to me that I cannot remember a situation post-cross when Jesus is in his resurrected state that he healed anybody. Can you?
Yeah.
Can you think of any? I mean, there might be.
I can't. It wouldn't bother me one way or the other. It's just not. It's the issue of the requirement of faith.
Well, I understand, but it's just interesting that before the cross, he's preaching the law defined, the correct interpretation of the law, and healing people, and doing things like walking on water, turning water into wine. Of course, during the resurrection period, he's walking through walls and stuff, but or the post-resurrection period. But I don't remember him going on around laying hands on people and raising people from the dead after he was resurrected.
No, I don't recall any of that either.
That's just an interesting point. 1-800-436-3260 is the Glenn Klein Online toll-free hotline. And we have Kim in Kauai, Iowa, in Kauai, Hawaii, calling. Hey, Kim, how are you tonight?
I'm fine, Glenn. How are you?
I am doing wonderfully. Thank you for caring enough to ask.
Good evening, Kim.
Aloha. Aloha.
Aloha.
You know, I have been to Kauai.
And you have?
Yes. We met a couple in, believe it or not, in Israel who lived 20 minutes from where we were staying. And we had a private picnic with them on the beach in Kauai, where they filmed South Pacific. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, isn't that? Yes, that is our island, Glenn. That's my wife, my dear wife, and I own this island. Yes.
Well, it's nice to talk to a Hawaiian landlord there, literally. How long?
Island lord. Yeah.
How long have you been in Hawaii?
Nearly 20 years, Glenn.
And how did you come across the gospel revolution over there on the island?
Right. Well, we met our dear brother Mike in 1995, actually. He came over to our little island.
Yes, that's correct.
And, we met him then in 95, so, yeah.
Hey, Kim, do you have your computer volume up?
No, I don't, Glenn. It's all the way down.
Yeah, we're just getting a little bit of feedback. It's all right. So
okay, just a sec here. Sorry. Let me do this. How's that? A little better?
It seems like that improved things.
Yeah.
Okay. Wonderful.
All right. So you're out there in Hawaii. What time is in Hawaii right now? About
Yes. Well, you know, we're 6 hours apart. So I'm a little after 3 o'clock.
Yes, that sounds.
P.M. Of course.
That sounds very nice, Hawaiian time.
Yeah, well, we're at 80 degrees and about 12 miles per and 50% humidity, so it's paradisal, to say the least.
and it's paradoxical that we're talking about paradise this evening, as we always do. So did you have a specific question for Michael?
Para something, I do. It's just a quick commentary, and I'll let you guys do what you do. Commentary question. My question, Glenn, is with regard to the subject of hell. And, well, if hell was created for Satan and his cohorts, my question is then, why is it so flagrantly mentioned with regard and relation to man as a place that he may go, which he won't ever? So my question is, why is there a flagrant mention of hell with regard to man? Mankind.
You want to take that one, Michael, or do you want me to take that one?
Well, that's the thing of it, Kim, is that it is not there. The mentions that are there, the definitions of hell, there's like four different terms for the word hell. Most of them show up as the term the grave, such as the one where we came up with the doctrine, you know, that Jesus went to hell after he died. I don't know what happened after Jesus died other than the fact that he rose and went to the Father. But we came up with a doctrine that Jesus went to hell for those 3 days because it said, thou shalt not leave my soul in hell. And the term hell there just simply means the grave. So
yes.
There just isn't any place that threatens man with what our concept of hell is. Now, even if it did, number one, hell, of course, those statements were all made before the cross. And of course, any future punishment, because we know that any future punishment, because Jesus said that when he went to the cross, that he was going to draw all punishment and judgment unto himself, as we taught on back on the island, you know, back in 95, I remember teaching on that actually while I was there. And, you know, the thing that we have to resolve is the big picture, and that is the fact, you know, if I ask anybody who has our traditional view of hell, that it's a place of punishment for sin. And, well, you can't have both, you know. You can't have...
Yes.
The cross is either the place of punishment for sin. If it is, there is no place, by definition or by direct statement, implicit or complicit, there is no place that that we can leave hell as a place for human beings to be punished for sin, which there is no other reason in any concept that modern-day Christianity has of hell other than that it's a place of punishment for that.
Kim, you still with us?
Hello?
I'm here,
yeah. Okay, Michael, can you hear us?
Yes, I can now. There was a dial tone.
Yeah, we had a dial tone there for a second. That was on our third line bleeding over. But Kim, one of the things that is really important to know about the whole concept of hell is that it's a Greek pagan concept. One of the words that's translated hell in the New Testament is the word Hades. And Hades was the Greek pagan underworld. And yeah. I'm getting a little feedback, Sean, if you can hear. But in every case where the King James Bible translates a word hell, it all comes from the same original Latin root, which is the same word we get hill from and hole and hull. Hell. It's all the same. And it basically all means the same thing, like Michael said. It basically means a place you go underneath, like the hull of a ship or the hull of a grave. And in no place, zero times, does it reference a place of eternal punishment. Even Hades is just referencing the Greek underworld. So it's really, what happened was it was a mistranslation, and then and then our good friends of the Roman Catholic Church took that doctrine to, you know, frankly, to control people's lives with it and to threaten them with H-E double hockey sticks.
Yeah, yeah.
And then with
Sheol, is Sheol
the grave. Then there's
so,
Gehenna. Gehenna.
Yes.
Gehenna was literally a place in Jerusalem. That at the time of Jesus, it was Jerusalem. I've been to Gehenna. I've been to hell. And it was the city's garbage dump, and when Jesus told the religious leaders that he would, if they did not repent when they saw Rome surrounding Jerusalem, that they would be killed and that they would be thrown into hell or Gehenna, and their bodies would burn with everlasting fire. He was telling what was coming. He was prophesying. He was predicting, and he told them. He said, "Get out, because those that will endure to the end will be saved." He told them to go to a place called Petra. Well, this was a huge schism in the Jewish community when this happened, because the Jewish believers left. And at that point, remember, the Jewish believers were going to the temple. They were still sacrificing animals. They were relatively cohesive with the other Jewish sects, and there were many Jewish sects. But when the Jewish believers left and they went to hide in this cave-like place called Petra, kind of a la Osama bin Laden, it caused a huge schism in the Jewish community, because the other Jewish non-believers stayed and fought. And guess what happened to the Pharisees and the Sadducees that did not believe Jesus' words and did not leave? They were slaughtered. And in an open show of defiance for Israel, Rome threw them in Gehenna. And guess how the Jews in those days got rid of their garbage?
Mm-hmm.
They burned it with everlasting fire.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you... So his words were accurate, but the interpretation was not. But as Michael, as you said, even if they were talking about a place of everlasting punishment, that was which they weren't, not in one case, the cross took care of even that, even if that were a possibility.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is the thing that has caused our minds to be opened up to think these irrational conclusions is because of the absence of the gospel. Because, you know, had the gospel been preached, the gospel of peace, if the gospel of peace had been preached, there would have not been the ability to translate something with a such a concept as a place of punishment, of any future punishment, or to even ever be taught, because the cross was the finishing place. The cross was the place that took all punishment, all wrath, all anger. And as Isaiah prophesied about the cross, and it said that God would see the suffering of his soul and would be satisfied. So anyone that says somebody else's soul is going to suffer for sin is a liar. I don't know how to put it any plainer.
That's been my concern. I mean, that's been my paramount concern, Michael. Pardon me. Yes. If it is complete, which it is, Jesus, you know, declared, cried out, "It is finished." Yeah. And with that, if any man, I mean, it's nearly, to me, it's ludicrous to think of, I mean, to think about having any separation at all anymore. I mean, eternally, from our Father. And so, you know, it's just something that, I mean, it's used so flagrantly. Even the term has become almost, you know, I mean, I know it's a generic term by and large in a lot of cases, but, you know, when you base it either biblically or scripturally, then, you know, it becomes something else, because was it indeed created for Satan and his cohorts? I mean, is that the abyss as well, or is that...
That's the only thing I know of the terminology. You know, and of course, I have friends that get into the issue about, you know, what's going to happen to the devil and his angels. And, you know, I'm a minister of the gospel to human beings, and I just really, maybe I should be concerned about angels, but I'm not.
And the one thing we know is that regardless of what happens to Satan and his cohorts, they were defeated as well. They have absolutely...
Yes.
And you always hear that in the Christian pulpits, in the media, how that Satan is still the god of this world. What a puny God Almighty that the Christian church believes in.
Right. Right. Yeah, indeed.
Well, Kim, thank you so much. And hey, listen, if you want, you can link on from the gospelrevolution.com website, or just go to whatthehellishell.com, and it lays it out. It's Gary Amaral's site. It's whatthehellishell.com with little dashes in between all the words. And Gary's got an exhaustive history. But just remember this, that hell was brought to you, the doctrine of hell was brought to you by the same people that brought us the doctrine of purgatory, which is absolutely not even, they just made that up. It also brought to you by the people that made up the concept of a pope, an infallible human being descended from Peter, who was supposed to be the first pope, who was married, by the way, because the Bible talks about Peter's mother-in-law, but the priest can't marry. And by the way, brought to you by the same people that said that you need a priest as an intermediary between you and God.
Oh, yes.
Therefore,
yes,
taking the place of Jesus.
Sure.
So they, at least they're, you know, horribly consistent. That's it.
No doubt.
Yeah. Horribly, yeah.
Horribly.
But,
hey,
yes,
Kim,
well, listen, thank you.
Stay logged on and enjoy the sunset in Kauai.
Tell your wife.
Oh, we shall. We shall indeed, yeah. Okay, well, yeah, we so appreciate you guys, and we just love the gospel of peace. That's it.
That's it.
So,
yeah.
Hope to see you soon. Still looking forward to you coming out here.
Yeah,
hope
well,
you can,
invite us anytime.
Yeah, well, believe me, I'm looking forward to it too, Kemp.
Okay, Michael, thank you so much. Glenn, all right, aloha, Keakua.
Aloha.
Aloha.
Everybody. All right, well, that's Kim and Kauai. And before we get to our guest, Michael, I want to get to this question because Christina in Houston has emailed this evening. And some of our questions, a lot of our questions are theological, like Kim just asked, but this is a very personal question as well as theological. She says, good evening, Michael. I would like to ask your advice on how someone that believes they have been lied to and deceived by their minister. What do you do?
What do you do? Well, it wouldn't be the first time that it ever happened. I would say of ministerial experiences, it's probably the most common experience, regret to say. But the number one thing when you have been, it doesn't make any difference whether it's your minister or who it is, you know, there is an incredible power to forgive. Of course, it depends on what the offense is. If it's criminal, it should be prosecuted. But whatever it is, still, the issue is, you know, our ability to move on and our ability to free ourselves. You know, I've come to find, you know, forgiveness is for my stability and peace of mind, not for the person whom I am forgiving. And, you know, when I saw forgiveness in that way, it really started becoming quite easy to forgive, you know, certainly more than the requirement to forgive.
Well, what I was going to say, Michael, excuse me for interrupting, but
no problem.
When you realize this is the best thing that you can do for yourself, ladies and gentlemen, and this is not a requirement in any way from God or from anybody else, from any given church or even from us. We're not requiring people that listen to the gospel to forgive. But when you realize that the best thing that you can do in your life is to be a giver, it is more blessed to give than receive, not by law, but by suggestion, by experience. It is more blessed to give than receive. And so forgiveness is exactly what it says. It's forgiving. So if you want to be a giver and you are in unforgiveness towards a minister or a pastor or a priest or a parent or a friend or a business partner or a spouse, you are not as capable of being a giver because some of that emotion and that effort of giving is being blocked up by bitterness. But this is one thing I would say to Christina and everybody else who's been out there, who's been hurt by a pastor or a minister or a priest. By the very nature of what most Christian churches teach, in fact, all Christian churches teach, they're all lying. They're all deceiving you. They may not know it. You might not know it. But if they're telling you that if you smoke, drink, or chew, or hang around with girls that do, that somehow God's not happy with you. If they're telling you that, like the poor family in Wisconsin whose daughter died this week, that the reason that she died was just because you didn't have enough faith, which we've all heard in the Word of Faith movement. If they're telling you that your tithe is somehow going to release the power of God to bless you financially, they're also deceiving you. They're also lying to you. So, you know, the one thing I would say to Christina and to everybody else out there who's been burned, and obviously anybody that's been in the church long enough has been, is you're in good company.
Yes, there's been a lot, and you know, one of my old friends, and I do mean old friends because they're not in communication anymore because of my stance on some points of the gospel, actually, and possibly some personal views. I'm not real sure, but there was a book out by that was entitled "Spiritual Abuse" by Ken Blue, and if you can find that book, it really is an excellent, excellent view of reconciling the abuse that can take place in a supposedly spiritual setting or religious setting, and to come to grips with that abuse, because it is, I mean, you know, one of the most common things in a religious structure is abuse. It's not blessing. It's not help. The most common thing is abuse, and kind of gets glossed over with the claims of help. And it's kind of amazing that so many places preach doctrines of guilt and judgment, and then have the audacity to offer the prayer and the help to get you free from the guilt and the judgment that they have imposed.
Well, what could be more abusive than to tell people that did not follow their hearts, but to follow the dictates of any given doctrine away from, at least arguably, what God had put them on the planet to do and to be.
Right. Any given doctrine or any person. And, you know, the power of the gospel is so that you can follow your own heart, not follow someone else. I have said for years that with the conclusion of my life and my ministry on this planet, that's for sure, is that I would see that the mark of my success is that when I die, I will have no followers. Because discipling somebody in Christ is not discipling them to follow you. You're discipling them to follow their heart. You say, but you say they should be being discipled to follow Jesus. Well, that's where he is. So you can't follow Jesus without following your own heart, because he is inexorably a part of you.
Yeah, but Michael, what if someone's heart leads them into trouble?
Well, that also is the place that you can follow and find your way out of. The thing of it is that everybody is going to wind up in trouble in the process of living life out. And the issue is that if you know that you can trust your heart, you can, if just the same as if your heart gets you in trouble, your heart can get you out.
And we, one thing that we have recognized as we walk down this the path of freedom in the gospel in Christ is that freedom's messy. All you got to look at is what happened when dictatorships in places like the Soviet Union and Iraq were lifted. What happened? People go crazy for a while, Michael, when freedom enters in. It's called life, ladies and gentlemen. You can't escape from it. Sorry.
Right. The process of our nation, you know, becoming a free country was to say it was tumultuous would be such a gross understatement. And, you know, it's, and it is, you know, the process of freedom is not a cut and dried thing, because it's dealing with the human heart, and that's why it's not a cut and dried thing.
Everything stemming from our founding has been a series of tumults and tribulations. I mean, think about this: we revolt against Great Britain. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, as an aside, if you have a chance to check out the new HBO miniseries on John Adams, just some tremendous stuff. Eventually it'll be out on DVD, but it's been running now the last couple of weeks on HBO about the founding of the country and specifically John Adams. But all the characters are there, and they wrestle with the issue of slavery at the Declaration of Independence. But to think for a second that we threw off the shackles from Great Britain only to keep other human beings in shackles for another 100 years and then another 100 years after that. The whole controversy, Michael, with Barack Obama's former pastor, Jeremiah Wright, we're talking about forgiveness. He clearly has not forgiven this country's history, and so he has a skewed view, as Obama said in his speech last week, of the progress that the United States has made. And, it's still true. What he says is true.
Yes.
Is that we did it during this freedom process, and as Obama himself said at his speech, as we continue to perfect this thing, this incredible experiment, we're far from there yet, but, it's been a messy, hypocritical, gruesome process. It's what life's all about, unfortunately.
Well, and it is vitally important that a person not just receive grace, but be established in grace. Because a person who only receives freedom will turn around and try to put somebody else in bondage.
Wow, say that again, please. That's a very powerful statement.
Well, the fact is that we not only need to receive grace, but we need to have our hearts established in grace, stabilized by grace. Because, I mean, you know, the process is there. Every preacher who gets up and preached at some point received freedom, and they turn around and put everybody else in bondage. Our nation, we got freedom, we put somebody else in bondage, and took them into slavery. And now we're seeing the very same thing with Jeremiah Wright, by his offense that he has. And I, you know, quite honestly, I'd say it's quite justifiable, based on the history, but, you know, justified is not the way to walk in freedom. You know,
or grace, if you will.
Yeah, that's no way to walk in grace. I never will forget reading the verse, things out of Proverbs, that says that he that justifieth himself condemneth himself with his own mouth. And, man, I tell you what, you can claim all the grace that you want, but if you start justifying your actions, and that's the big difference in grace, is that the gospel and freedom is here to validate me, not my actions. And so many times we see people take the grace of God and then try to imply that the grace of God is validating that their actions are correct.
Hmm.
And the gospel has nothing to do with validating your right and wrong. Why would the gospel validate good or evil when that's the tree that we're supposed to be set free from? So the real deadly part of this, and the transition that many people don't make it through, is being freed from that insidious backlash of receiving freedom and then turning around and putting other people in bondage.
And the one other thing I would say to Christina is that the gospel levels the playing field for everybody. As far as God is concerned, we are all in Christ, and we're as righteous and holy as Christ. Given the right or wrong set of circumstances, we are all capable of the worst kinds of injustices. And, you know, people have often say to us, Michael, you're telling me that Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler, and Saddam Hussein, and Pol Pot, are in heaven right now? And we say, yes, that's how powerful the cross was. But in recognizing that's how powerful it was, you also have to recognize the power of genetics and the power of circumstances and the power of mental illness. A lot of this stuff that comes from the ministers is their answer, or they try to have it be their antidote to their mental illness. They don't know they're doing it, but I certainly was in that category, and a lot of the people that are in positions of power in religion are there to try to satisfy their own insecurities and their own attempt to control their lives by controlling other people's lives. One of the tried and true axioms is if you want to know what a minister is generally dealing with in their lives, just listen to their preaching. They preach real hard against what they're struggling with in private. And, of course, many times, especially in the higher profile ministers, that has spilled over into the public arena. 1-800-436-3260 is the toll-free number on Glenn Klein Online. It's Wednesday night. It's Michael Williams. It's the Gospel Revolution. And we want to welcome on to the Gospel Revolution webcast from beautiful Pennsylvania, Mr. George Howell of BoldGrace.com. George, you are online. How are you?
Hey, what's up, guys?
Brother George.
How's it going?
If it was going any better, I'd probably be in Tampa or Houston.
Are you in Pennsylvania tonight?
Yes, I am. Actually, I'm home. I've been home for pretty much the whole month. We've been pretty slow here. It's been my job for the first 3 months of the year, and we're getting ready to hit the road next week again.
Well, you get to be home for the political assault on Pennsylvania.
Are
they on the air yet with ads over there?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's like I said. This is southwestern Pennsylvania is a different part of the world. I'll just say that.
Well, George, of course, is the host of BoldGrace.com, and last week when he heard Michael's and my discussion with Eric, who called at the end of the webcast, and we recommended that in the same conversation that Eric stay with the Mormon church that he was asking about how to get out of, and then when he before he left the discussion, he told us that he had been struggling with pornography most of his life, and I suggested that he stay with that too until he didn't want to anymore. In other words, we were doing what we said, Michael, just a few minutes ago, that we recommend that he follow his heart. So George, who's got this Bold Grace website, boldgrace.com, he sent out this email to his list. He said, just wanted you to know, actually I don't have that particular, but anyway, George, you told people to listen to that because this was Bold Grace.
Right.
And so then he got an email, did George, from one of his readers, and I want to read that. And it said, I listened to the webcast twice, and whether I agree with the advice given to this man or disagree with it is besides the point. In fact, I'm not sure one way or the other. I believe we have to use wisdom and common sense on how this great gospel of grace and peace is presented to people, and it certainly was not used during that webcast. In cases like they encountered with this man, I think it is best to be handled in a more private way than on the internet. It is okay for most of us that have come to the knowledge of the gospel to listen to this sort of thing, whether we agree with it or not, but it's certainly not something that the world out there needs to hear. It's just a further turnoff for them, and I found it to be in very poor taste in that respect. And then, George, I loved your response. You said, I totally understand your feeling that way. I used to feel that same sentiment, but I come to realize that it was and is the only thing that will set people free. Maybe for too long we have worried about what the, quote, Christian world, unquote, would think if we preached the gospel of grace and peace to its end. But maybe it is time to not be ashamed of this gospel that Paul preached any longer. Will the world think that we are nuts and crazy? Absolutely. But if we must be excluded by the Christian world and the world because of this message, then so be it. This message of complete freedom will and does set the captives free. The initial response by people may to be to go and do the behavior more. This message to do the behavior more, but in time, it will cease as long as that person knows the behavior has no standing between them and God. I know in my mind that young man heard the gospel for the first time last Wednesday night. And now that that seed has been planted, it will be worked by our loving Savior to its completion. But these are just my beliefs. I could be and may be totally wrong. I love that, George. But he closes, George closes with, I so much appreciate how we can share what we think and feel here at Bold Grace. I am also so happy that you are there. Thanks for what you add. George, that was such a great response, and it was great that fellow had the freedom to write you that. But Michael, that's the answer, isn't it? I mean, we are not ashamed of the gospel. We have nothing to hide. We said this in many different ways and in many different venues. But the gospel is the power of God unto salvation, unto the renewing and the cleansing of the soul.
Yes, and you know, if the church were dealing with these questions in private, I would deal with them in private. But the church is not dealing with these questions in private. They are telling people to fight this. They are telling people to enter into an eternal struggle with their humanity and for righteousness. And I was actually very glad that he had the comment about, you know, what do I do about my drawback to the Mormon Church, even though I'm understanding grace. I mean, how crazy would it have been to tell the man, well, you need to stay away from that church. And if that is true in that situation, even the same with any sexual proclivity. And of course we're not saying anything about breaking laws. That's a whole different category altogether. But, the fact of it is that most of these obsessive compulsive behaviors with sexual addictions and religious addictions, because I think they are quite, hand in hand in so many cases.
It would certainly seem to be that way.
Well, yes. Well, especially, well, our caller certainly proved that to us. And my goodness, look at our, TVs and our airways are filled with these two faces, of religion. And so being in that position to where we actually got to address this openly. And like I say, if preachers and pastors were dealing with this secretly, then telling people this, maybe I could find some rationale to do that. But man, I tell you what, if this is where they're bringing people into such bondage, is by telling them these rules and laws about sex, and then obsessions begin, and it leads to I honest to God believe that their teachings about masturbation, their teachings about just the basic desire to see, a nude body or a sexual act, that by making that such a horrible crime in the eyes of God, that it actually produces obsessive compulsive behavior.
No doubt.
Turns destructive for the individual and destructive for, for others. I think that's a great deal of where rapists and, people who force their sexual desires on others is because of a suppression of normal sexual desires, just being human.
Yes, the preaching in the church guarantees full altars is what it does. And because people continue, just like Paul said, that the law adds power to the temptation. That's New Testament writing, ladies and gentlemen. Paul said that. Temptation adds power. Excuse me, the law adds power to the temptation. And George, you back with us?
Yes, we got it. We got you.
Yeah, what I was going to say, and I loved your letter, like I said, but our observation over these many years now, well over a decade, almost 15 years now, is exactly what you said, that ultimately it seems like if people, as Michael said early, will be established in grace, not just receive freedom, but will be established in grace, that eventually these things do moderate and there is freedom from them in a very real sense.
Right. The other thing that occurred to me, just as you said, over the last 10 years, it occurred to me that there's becoming an acceleration of people learning this gospel. It's been 10 years for you guys. It's only been 3 for me. And it seems like I'm seeing people coming behind, they're starting to pick it up a lot faster.
Yes.
And it's truly an amazing thing.
Well, one of the things about the information age and with 24-hour news cycles, on television and the internet and everything else, is that the information gets out so much. I mean, right now we're talking to people around the world. That wasn't the case 10 years ago.
Right.
And we see examples in the work of the law all over the place. I mean, every single day something else happens, it seems like, that validates what we're talking about. Now, as Michael has said before, even if nothing was happening that would validate our sense of the gospel in this perspective, it still wouldn't invalidate, Michael, the work of the cross. But it just, we're finding examples in the Bible about that being established in grace is a stabilizing factor, does stabilize the heart. You know, we have to say that we're finding this. And, Michael, we weren't necessarily finding it, you know, 8, 9, 10 years ago so much. But now, looking back on it more than a decade later, we can say this seems to be what's happening. We can give a good report. As you said, George, we might be wrong, but this is what we're seeing.
But I don't think so. You know, the other thing that occurred to me this week, and we put a post on boldgrace.com about it this week, too, was also about the wording of the choices between right and wrong. And I had a discussion with my wife this week. I told her, I said, you know, I've come to realize that I no longer make decisions based on what's right or wrong. My decisions are based on what is either beneficial or profitable for me and my family. And she said, well, she said, that's kind of just semantics. And we went around and around. I said, you know, I really don't think it's just semantics, because right and wrong, if you make a decision and it turns out to be, quote, wrong, then it makes it harder to make your next decision. And if you get a bunch of decisions that turn out wrong, the heart becomes frozen and fearful and questioning everything that you do. If you make a decision that's either unprofitable or unbeneficial later on down the road based on the current knowledge that you didn't have when you first made that decision, you can make a different decision.
Well, and Michael, that's exactly what you were saying earlier. I don't know if you heard it, George. But
no,
if your heart leads you in a quote, wrong, or the way you would articulate it, an unprofitable situation, then it just goes to reason that your heart could lead you into a profitable or beneficial situation.
Right, exactly. You know, it's
same
funny.
Tool that would lead you out of the situation that you're in instead of staying there. And,
yeah.
You know, I did a teaching, and I think that everybody's kind of struggling to get away from those terms of good and evil, right and wrong. And I did a series on wise and unwise.
Yeah.
And that the foundation of our decision making process, if you know that, and it's basically the same thing that you're saying. And of course, we've got plenty of understanding from the Bible on wisdom or a lack of wisdom, and making decisions based on that. And it doesn't have to do anything, it doesn't have to have anything to do with right or wrong or
right.
Good or evil.
You know, it was amazing because I realized as I was saying this to my wife, I had this like eureka moment. Have you ever said something where you didn't know that you believed it and you were saying it, and as you're saying it, you're believing it?
Yeah, yeah, but Michael has that all the time when he's speaking.
You know, and I said it, and I was like, "Wow, where did that come from?" And you realize this thing of right and wrong just destroys people. And I, you know, it's funny because I had another email response to that, and the person basically said, "Well, you know, you have to make decisions based on right and wrong because this and that and the other thing." And he's like, "You know, profitable, unprofitable, or beneficial, not beneficial." He says that doesn't work either. He says because he said it could be beneficial and then not be beneficial. And everything he was relating to me was, it seemed like he thought that when I said beneficial or profitable, I was talking about to just me. In other words, he was saying you could steal money and it'd be beneficial to you. Well, no, stealing money is never going to be beneficial to you.
That's right.
You know, I don't know why it seems like the world thinks that when we say these things, we're thinking of ourselves. And we're not, because we are thinking of ourselves, but by thinking of ourselves, we're thinking of others also, because we are all connected.
Right.
Well,
and anything that I do that hurts me is going to hurt the world.
Mm-hmm. And that is very true. And I think that that is the heart that is established in grace. And we were addressing that, the difference between receiving grace and getting established in grace, because those who receive grace have a tendency to turn right around and put those the next generation or the people around them in bondage. And it really is vitally important that the heart becomes established in grace. But the heart that is established in grace doesn't think about just yourself. It does go, I mean, you wind up and your heart and your mind goes through this computer speed calculation, if you will, of the impact of the actions that you are espousing. And let me tell you, there's an awful lot that people can do under the issue of morality that has nothing to do with harming themselves or somebody else. And there are a lot of things under the issues of morality that people can do to harm themselves and others.
Right.
And which goes into criminal behavior.
Right.
But the thing of it is, the way you stay out of the criminal behavior in the first place is know that you're free to do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Until that is established in the heart, the ability to stay out of criminal behavior and self-destructive behavior and the destruction of others is to first let your heart be established in the grace of God for yourself. And then it establishes your heart in grace for everyone around you. You're, in the gospel, your world gets bigger. No matter what anybody says, your world gets bigger when your heart is established in grace. You see everyone differently.
Why is that, Michael?
Well, number one is the two things that Paul said that the gospel will remove. And I have been a proponent of this statement for many years now, that the power of the gospel is not revealed by what it adds to our life. The true power of the gospel is revealed by what it subtracts from our life. And the two deadly components of human nature is guilt and judgment.
Yes.
Those two components are the keys for so many mental illnesses. I mean, you can, and physical illness. I mean, we have seen studies come out recently and over the last 20 years or so where they finally began to realize the power that guilt has, the negative power that guilt has, and the negative power that judgment has in the heart of a human being. So the reason the world gets bigger is because, number one, you don't feel rejected by God, and then on the next part, you don't go around judging other people's relationship with God. And please be very careful with that term judgment, because just because I tell you that what you're doing is wrong, or what you are doing is unhealthy or unwise, or I don't like it, I may just stand right in your face and say, I don't like what you're doing.
Exactly.
I'm not judging you unless I'm telling you that your relationship with God is impeded by what you do. It doesn't mean I have no opinions about things. That doesn't make my opinions right. But when we start trying to imply that you're being judgmental or you're legalistic because you have an opinion, that's when we are looking at a heart that has received grace but not been established in grace. Because it only wants, it's like a child, it only wants its own, and it's not concerned about anything else around it. You know, it only knows when it's hungry, it only knows when, you know, he's cold, and he only knows when, the child only knows what his wants and his needs are. But as the heart matures in grace, you just mature in grace. But one of the signs that it has, that we're stuck, is when we begin to misdefine, if you will, the terminology of legalism and judgment. And, you know, I can tell you all day long I don't like what you do. And it doesn't make me a legalist.
Absolutely.
You know, a couple of months ago we had that gentleman call in who was being bombarded with thoughts of suicide. And I have to say, you know, we had him on, George, for about a half an hour or more.
Yeah, I heard that,
as we talked him through it. And I was tempted to not recommend the gospel to him.
Yeah.
Sure you are.
And to not say, follow your heart and know that no matter what you decide to do, God is not moved. His opinion of you has been settled at the cross. And yet I did. And because I'm not ashamed of the gospel, and I believe in it, and I believe that it's the most beneficial advice and opinion that I could give another human being, especially when they are in a cycle that is unprofitable or that is not beneficial, as you say. And we heard from the gentleman several weeks later, and he said that he had decided not to kill himself because he felt that even though he knew it was okay with God, that if it would somehow harm any of his children or anybody that cares about him, that he would hang around for a while. And see, Michael, that's exactly what you're saying. It made his world, by receiving and by being established in the gospel, in the grace of God, it made his world bigger. He considered his plight beyond just his own little life. And that was very powerful. And so, George, in the same way, especially given the title of your website, Bold Grace, we're especially wanting to share this with people who are struggling or who have questions. Either, Michael, either this is the power of God or it's not. Laying out of hands is not the power of God. Falling over, speaking in tongues, seeing so-called, that's not the miracles. That's not the power of God. The power of God is the gospel. And it has a transformational effect on the human heart when it's received and when it's established. I mean, it's beautiful.
And, you know, the thing of it is we've seen the results of the other. I just don't understand why we would be afraid to go with this and let's see what it does instead of trying to be a guard for the gospel.
Right, George.
I remember years ago, man, I tell you, it was one of my closest relationships and in the ministry, and it was the last time I spoke, because when I got up, I knew in my heart, and I started just sharing from my heart, and I said, you know, at the time when the gospel is rising to such a level that it's ready to spill over the dam that has been built by religion to hold back grace and peace, that the very speakers of grace and peace, at the moment that this dam is about to overflow, instead of just letting it go, in my mind's eye, I could see that they were wanting, the people who were preaching grace were wanting to build the dam higher. Because even though they wanted the grace, they didn't want it to go out to everybody, because they were concerned about how somebody would be affected by it. If you start telling people they're freed from the tithe, you know, we're going to go broke. Well, they were right about that, but I'm still not remorseful about freeing people from these freedom. I let them know about their freedom.
Even in that, like you were talking about the tithe, aren't you, after these 10 years now, aren't you starting to see a turnaround in that now, though?
The thing of it is that turnaround financially, it is so amazing, because, you know, we bit the dust financially, and we couldn't pay the bills, and not only that, but there was no, even though I was still sharing the gospel, it certainly wasn't providing anything for me. Debt had accumulated. Because I took the funds that I had, which was disappearing in other ways, but the funds that I did have, I was taking $10,000 at a time out of the stock market back in the late 90s, and trying to fuel the ministry and try to keep it going,
right.
And it all collapsed. But there's something else being built here. And I look back on it now, George, and I am so grateful that it all collapsed. I'm so grateful that it all died, because now I can feel really confident, because I know that we're not building anything on a false foundation. I'm not hiding from people who or what I am personally, And I am not trying to justify the gospel by withholding it from people. How do we think that we are justifying the gospel by withholding it? How do we think that we are helping the gospel by withholding the wisdom that comes with the gospel? It just doesn't make sense. And like you said, you know, I understand the concerns. But you see, this gospel has been robbed from generation after generation after generation. And it needs to be clearly spoken. And we don't need to be ashamed of the gospel whatsoever. And if it's the power of God, it's the power of God. If it's not, it's not. I don't have anything else to go back to.
Well, you made a point earlier, Michael, about kind of, and you see this all the time in the churches, and we certainly have seen it in the gospel. We know that hiding certain truths that we see doesn't work.
Right.
Absolutely.
So to keep trying to figure it out and to try to soften it up and have it be receivable by somebody who theoretically is not in a place to receive it, we know that doesn't work. Yeah. So as we said 1,000 times, we'll say it 1,000 times more, it is insanity to keep doing the same old damn thing and thinking that you're going to get different results.
Glenn, I'd like to close on my end part. It's just, you know, there's the old Chinese proverb, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And I so much believe that yeah, when the person is ready, someone will be there.
Well, one thing's for sure, George, is if they're asking, they're getting to a place of being ready. That's for sure.
Exactly. And anyway, I know you guys are getting ready to close up. I wanted to say that BoldGrace.com is not just me. It's Bruce Dragonjack, it's Cliff Hazelbaker, it's Steve West, and it's Mindy Hill.
Yeah.
I wanted to
good
make
group
sure
of folks.
They got we spent 3 days one month with out in Indiana together. So.
Well, George, thanks a lot for your participation. That's BoldGrace.com, folks, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, man. Hey, take care. I love you, Mike.
Love you too.
All right, babe. Talk to you later. Bye.
Don't you love me, George?
Oh, I'm glad he was still on.
Yeah, he was muted, but we heard you, George. I know you love me. You know, I've got to, and we are over time, but I've got to make a couple points, and I want to talk for a couple minutes about your time in Dallas, Michael, in Plano with the Eatons.
Oh my!
But you know, we talked about how, and George was talking about if it's bad for me, it's bad for the whole world because we're all connected.
Yeah.
Did you see in the last couple of days it came out the lineage of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton? And just in Barack's case, they trace his lineage back to 6 different presidents and and Dick Cheney.
Yep.
He's got both Bushes in his lineage. He's got LBJ. He's got James Madison. He's got who else was it? There were a couple others, but it just, and Hillary's got all kinds of people. Oh, Winston Churchill is in Barack Obama's lineage. You know, there was a scientific study that came out a number of years ago that said that they traced our lineage all back, all, A-L-L, to one couple.
Yeah.
And it kind of is reminiscent of the Garden of Eden, isn't it, folks? And we know genetically that we're all very, very close to each other. And, Michael, the truth of the matter is, as far as in Christ is concerned, we are all one in Him. There's some physical manifestations of it and some potential evidence of it, but you talk about making the world bigger. We are literally all brothers and sisters.
Absolutely.
And certainly all righteous in Christ. This is Glenn Klein Online. We're running over a couple minutes because I want Michael to talk about his time in Plano, Texas, in the Dallas area. This will be a teaching that will be coming out later. But, you know, this is all on the topics that we've been talking about tonight, Michael, where you saw, and just talk for a minute about what you saw about in the book of Hebrews about good and evil.
Well, I had studied the book. I've studied the book of Hebrews for decades, and I'm very passionate about the book of Hebrews. It has been one of the keys of my understanding, the most fundamental principles about the gospel and the most solid principles about the gospel are taught However, verses out of context in the book of Hebrews that are taken out of place, and actually where Paul is saying what the wrong doctrine is. It's very interesting all the way through the book of Hebrews when Paul is saying the way it's not, and he's teaching it so well, then he says, wherefore? And I started seeing that, and it's like, oh my gosh, you know, it's even in the terms that he used shows that he's changing the subject matter here. And he's saying, because this is our perception, now this is what we have to understand to keep from falling into those false understandings. And the bizarre thing is that the church has picked up the parts where Paul was simply quoting what the people believe and didn't get to his wherefore. And they leave his wherefore out as though it's some strange doctrine and have adopted the entire false concepts, the debunking. I call it Paul's debunking teaching. And he would teach something and debunk it, because he could teach it better than the people who believed it, and depending on whoever he was addressing. And but in Hebrews chapter 5, it always puzzled me. At the end of Hebrews chapter 5, it talks about the last two, three verses there about the difference between milk and meat. And it says that, that the one person that's still on milk is unskilled in the word of righteousness. And if you read the context of that, you see that he's talking about someone who is still a student of the law or the old covenant, or still stuck in the old covenant as a concept of relationship with God. And he says that that's someone who's on milk and they are not skilled in the word of righteousness. But strong meat belongeth to them that are full age and have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. And it just was so contrary to me, because it's like, now wait a minute. Once you get established in the word of righteousness, it's going to teach you how to discern the difference between good and evil. And it's like suddenly, it's like for the first time, you know, you get told something all your life. And when you think you understand stuff and you realize, my God, we're still almost in our infancy of understanding these great truths of the gospel. And and I look back at it again, and it said that once that when you come into the understanding the word of righteousness, and strong meat belongeth to them that are full age, it says who by reason of using the word of righteousness, we have our senses exercised to discern both good and evil. It didn't say good from evil.
Right.
And remember what it was that we had that man partook of. He partook of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It's the exact same quote from Genesis. So what he's saying is that we recognize the tree of the knowledge of good and evil real quickly. When you understand righteousness, you are able to spot the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It's like, I don't want to feed from that.
Right.
And then the list of doctrines that he goes in and says the teachings of Christ that need to be laid aside. And the second one is the doctrine of faith toward God.
And because the teaching of Christ was the teaching of the law. That's what he taught.
Absolutely.
He taught the law in its final interpretation, not just the letter of it, but the spirit of it.
Absolutely, the full impact of it, if you will. And to realize that faith toward God, Glenn, is a part of partaking of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And it just blew me away.
Yeah,
I mean,
now that we're talking about it,
I'm seeing more.
Yeah, that would. Did you hear what he said, folks? Faith towards God is partaking of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It's like this. Yeah. It's like what the serpent said to Eve. If you'll participate or partake of this fruit,
yes,
you will be like God.
Yes. Do your part. This is your part. This is your role. And when you start telling people that they have a role in this redemption and relationship with God, whether it's their faith or their works or their belief, you are teaching them to partake of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But see, people who have their senses exercised in the word of righteousness,
which is Christ, which is the gospel.
Absolutely,
we could call our senses exercised. We could call that the renewing of the mind. We could call that salvation, if you will.
Absolutely. Then we know that one of the doctrines we can leave behind is faith toward God, which is affirmed through chapter 6, all the way through 10 and 11, and then telling us about this big, great cloud of witnesses, but then tells us that these all, having obtained a good report, never received the promise. And then it says, therefore, seeing that we have this great cloud of witnesses about faith, what are they witness to? That their faith didn't get them the promise. That's what the witness is.
We have no faith towards God.
Yes.
Hallelujah.
Yes. Free at last. Free at last.
But thank God, ladies and gentlemen, we have come to the place that we know that God has faith in us.
Yes.
His faith in us is as solid, as rock solid, as his faith is in Jesus Christ.
It is transforming.
Yay. I just want to hear some angels singing, hallelujah, 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 hallelujah. No faith towards God, God's faith in us.
Because Hebrews chapter 12, the next verse says, looking unto Jesus. What did we do all the way through the Word of Faith movement? We kept looking to those people, the heroes of the Hall of Fame of Faith. We tried to copy what they did, and it says they didn't get it. And it says, therefore, seeing that we have such a great cloud of witnesses, what were they witness to? The failure of their own faith to get the promise from God. And lo and behold, the next verse says, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of faith. Now, the term our in the King James Version is italicized because it's not in the original text. And it literally says, Jesus was the author and the finisher of faith. To teach a human being they have to have faith in God is to feed them from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
Wow. Well, that was a little snippet, ladies and gentlemen, of what was taught at the Eaton's, the library in Plano, Texas. And it will be a future teaching. CDs available. And what a great place to finish, Michael, yes, is that you don't have to have faith. In fact, we recommend that you not have faith towards God,
yes,
but be confident in God's faith towards
Jesus.
Even, Michael, if the hour was in there originally, it still would come from Jesus. It still would have nothing to do with us.
Yes, it finishes our faith. But the fact is that the broader context is faith as a subject has been fulfilled by Jesus.
So my assumption is the folks in Plano had a very pleasant experience, as did you.
Well, you know, we had some very bright people up there in that room. You know, we had people who've been students of theology and the Bible and ministry for many years. I was honored to have these people sitting and listening to me. It's like, I need to sit down and listen to them. These are some brilliant people here. But they all walked away saying that they had a lot of things to think about, and which is all I ever ask.
It's called exercising your senses.
That's right.
That's a beautiful thing. Well, we want to remind everybody that Michael will be next month in April in Western Canada. Stay logged on to the website at gospelrevolution.com for the specifics of that. That's happening in mid to late April. And, of course, the Gospel Revolution Convention coming your way in Houston. We hope you've circled it in your on your calendars, November 5th through the 9th of this year. Again, more information will be coming to you. And I'm on gospel overload. I feel very good right now, Michael.
Oh, good. I do too.
Sean, do you feel good?
I feel good.
Sean O'Halloran, ladies and gentlemen, feels great. And our studio audience, Kristen, how are you feeling?
Great.
She feels great. Well, we hope you feel good too, folks. And regardless,
and we went through some territory tonight.
Yeah, we sure did. And so you may want to re-log on to the webcast.
I think I need to go listen to this.
Good preaching, Michael. All right, well, thank you. And next week I will be, Lord willing, in the Creek Don't Rise in the glorious Northwoods of Wisconsin, freezing my tuchus off probably. And we'll be coming to you remotely from Wisconsin and Houston for the next couple of weeks. But you stay logged on. We only got to one email. We've got all these email questions. Folks, if you've emailed us, just stay put. And I'm sure you are being touched and having your senses I like that. Your senses exercised.
Yes. Yeah.
Exercise is a good thing.
We are census exercise group.
We are sensory exercisers. Love that. Love it. All right, well, we want to thank Kristen Sherrar, our studio audience. Kristen, yell hello to everybody. And with Sean O'Halloran, our engineer, producer, and call screener extraordinaire. Michael, thank you, as always, at the Gospel Revolution.
Thank you, Glenn.
Visit
thanks
us at thegospelrevolution.com website. Stay logged on there. And until we talk again, ladies and gentlemen, this is Glenn Klein Online saying, Shalom, everybody!